This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Rich Robinson tells us why so much of the money donated to candidates running for Michigan Supreme Court is unreported and unregulated. But first, much has been said and written since the Supreme Court ruling that found that marriage is a legal right extended to same-sex couples in the United States. We're going to spend some time with a couple from Kalamazoo whose marriage is now recognized in Michigan because of the Supreme Court's ruling. We were put in touch with Jonathan and Gabriel Renteria Elier by the Kalamazoo Gay and Lesbian Resource Center. Gabriel and Jonathan, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Tell us a little bit about yourselves to begin with. When did you first meet?
Gosh, we met probably back in, 2007? Mm-hmm. Something like that. And I'd actually just moved here from Los Angeles, where I grew up. And I came for my job to play with the symphony. And I was holding a Thanksgiving that November at my place. And it happened to be a gay Thanksgiving.
And that's where... Yeah, it was for people that might not have families to go home to. And I was just dropping off dessert on my way to my family Thanksgiving, which I wasn't all that thrilled about going to at the time, because there was some tension in my family at the time with me coming out. And Gabriel answered the door, and I was kind of taken with him. And so the whole time I was at my family's, I wanted to get back to their Thanksgiving. And
So he purposely left his cookie sheet so he could come back and pick it up later.
Well played. And at what point would you say you really started a relationship?
Well, probably within maybe 3 or 4 months, we kind of started to get a little bit more, you know, regular dating. And
at what point did you start talking about marriage?
Gosh, that probably took, 3 years?
Yeah.
Probably about 3 years. And then, you know, we kind of had the talk about, you know, where we thought our relationship was going and what we wanted to do, whether we wanted to have a family, whether we wanted to, you know, settle down and get married. And at that point, of course, marriage, you know, in terms of the legality of it, didn't exist for us. So it would have been really a ceremony that we would have been talking about at that point.
Which is what we planned. And then we had a ceremony with our close friends and some family in 2011. A friend officiated and we made our vows, but there was no contract, you know, no recognition. We were still considered roommates by the state of Michigan and the country.
But you did eventually get married. Where and when did that happen?
In 2013, after the Defense of Marriage Act was struck down by the Supreme Court, we went back to California, where Gabriel is from, and we got the license there.
Yeah. And I mean, for us, of course, our marriage was the initial one that we had, our ceremony. And this was kind of, you know, jumping through the hoops and getting the certificate so that at least we have some rights.
Yeah, because at that point, at least if we went to a hospital that took federal money, then they would have to recognize the marriage. So, you know, we could visit each other, you know, in case of emergency or something like that.
And right.
So there were a bundle of rights that came just federally. Social Security benefits, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And this was because the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act.
Yes. Yes.
This right now, when you look back on that, it seems like a small step towards the greater victory in the same-sex marriage case or marriage equality case. But for gay couples at the time, how important was that, especially for a couple like yourself who, yes, could go to California and get married, but then plan to come back to Michigan where it was not going to be recognized by this state?
Right. Well, it was, you know, ultimately a tiny little step, but for us, it still felt quite huge just to have those basic rights. When we would file our taxes, we had to do the two separate ones, a joint federal and then separate Michigan.
Yeah, we had just single state taxes, but married joint federal taxes.
Right. But it was still huge again because of that. You know, even just knowing that if something happened, we would have at least some protection.
Yeah, that was a big step in just, yeah. I mean, for the whole country, really.
And, right.
And the future marriage cases that, you know, went through the court system in each state were citing that. So it really helped a lot and it was very big.
Yeah. So at that point, it was kind of like the tumble of all the rocks that eventually would lead to what happened on Friday.
And where were you when you heard that the U.S. Supreme Court had issued a ruling that said that marriage is a fundamental right extended to all couples, including same-sex couples?
Well, I was at work watching the Supreme Court blog roll, and there's a huge buildup of anxiety each day that there's a decisions released, because you don't know what's going to be on the docket. You just have to wait and see. So every day there's this big buildup, and then usually a letdown. But that day, 10 o'clock, I'm watching the blog roll, and just one word came up. It said marriage, and my heart stopped. Cause like, this is it. They're gonna do it. And then the next one, it said Kennedy majority 5-4, we won. And I leapt out of my chair. I was so excited. And I immediately tried to call Gabriel and couldn't get a hold of him for about an hour.
I wasn't expecting the ruling to happen till maybe Monday. And so I wasn't, I didn't have my phone with me, and I was out having breakfast with a friend of mine who's turning 80 this month, and he happens to be gay himself. And so we were just out to breakfast, and finally when I came back to my phone, I saw that I had several missed calls, and that's when I found out about the news.
And our friend, he never thought this would happen. He was astonished, 80 years old. He's seen so much history and, gone through so much.
Right.
How important does it feel to you that now your marriage in the state you live is recognized?
Oh, I mean, it's very important. It was such an emotional experience. I mean, there was a celebration with the community at Bronson Park that evening, and gosh, people were just in tears.
Yeah, it's very important. And Justice Kennedy mentioned the dignity that was finally extended to us, by recognizing our marriage. Like I said before, the state of Michigan considered us roommates, and we've both been turned away trying to get our driver's license updated with our correct name at the Secretary of State. So there's a dignity that comes with it, and that's very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it was ridiculous. We came back to Michigan after having the legal marriage certificate from California, and we tried changing our names, and we did it through the passport, no problem. Through Social Security, no problem. But once we get to the Secretary of State, we had those documents and they just would not take it.
You mentioned before that you've had some discussion about starting a family. Still interested in that?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you taken any steps about it? Talked to adoption agencies, anything like that?
We're still a few years away, so we haven't started that yet. But that kind of started the whole thing with Michigan, with April DeBoer and Jane Rouse. It was just trying to have them both on their children's adoption paperwork that started it all. So we owe them a lot. And
right. When we talked about it, like I said, we would probably never have imagined that this was going to happen. And so part of the reason we wanted to wait was, enjoy ourselves in the marriage without having that extra responsibility. And also just to see what happens with rights, the legal thing. We have so many friends who have been in long-term committed relationships, and they had to spend thousands of dollars on lawyer fees just to get those very basic rights. And one, we don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend on legal fees, so we wanted to wait a little bit, and now it's getting to the point where it's some of those steps are becoming a little bit easier.
Does the Supreme Court decision move up the timetable at all, where you say, well, our marriage is recognized in Michigan, perhaps maybe it's time to start moving a little bit on the idea of adopting?
I wouldn't say it necessarily moves up the time. At this point, when we first talked about it, we said, well, let's wait about 10 years or so. And at this point, it's probably, what, like 3 or 4 years away, which is close enough.
It'll probably be a 2-3 year process. So we'll have to start
within
the next
year or two. Yeah.
What obstacles do you see out there in terms of acceptance? For instance, it is still legal in the state of Michigan to fire somebody simply because they're gay. Do you see some of those things as being the next step now that gay marriage has been settled by the Supreme Court?
Yes, I believe, just having a ruling saying that 14th Amendment applies to us is huge. And we do have a long ways to go in the state, but hopefully we'll, use this momentum and go on to the next battle. Our transgender brothers and sisters have, an even harder battle than we have. And, people in Lansing working against them and against us as well. But I think they get a harder time than even we do when people are still, you know, working out of fear and ignorance. So.
Right. And I mean, it's going to change eventually. How quickly it happens, I don't know. But just even with the younger generations, you see that acceptance and that, and just that freedom of expression, even amongst themselves.
I wonder if there's also a component to this Supreme Court ruling that kind of goes beyond its legal ramifications, and that is just maybe societal acceptance. You know, Jonathan, you mentioned that your family had some tensions over you coming out. And I'm wondering if you think that the fact that now the Supreme Court has put its mark on this decision maybe means that for somebody in future years, their family will view it differently when they come home and break the news to them.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, just having that recognition on that kind of level, I mean, it's just going to affect people subconsciously, even if they don't necessarily are aware of it. It's, you know, we have that, I don't want to say stamp of approval, but I mean, you know, that recognition there.
As more people see that the sky hasn't fallen
today,
and it probably won't tomorrow, I think they'll maybe start to relax a little bit about things.
Gabriel and Jonathan, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jonathan and Gabriel Renteria Elie were married in California in 2013. That marriage is now recognized in Michigan, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In a new report on the lack of disclosure related to contributions for Michigan Supreme Court and State Attorney General, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Rich Robinson concludes that Michigan has won the race to the bottom when it comes to campaign finance transparency related to the administration of justice. The report on unreported and unregulated spending is called Dark Money and Justice. Michigan is like no other state. Rich Robinson, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Gordon.
So how did Michigan reach what you call the bottom?
Well, we have had this culture of unreported, unregulated television advertising in our Supreme Court campaigns in particular since the turn of the century. There were a couple spots, 2004, 2006, where it wasn't a particularly large factor because the majority on the court wasn't particularly at stake in the election. But other than that, it's been a feature of our Supreme Court election campaigns really since 2000. It's been relatively less common in our attorney general campaigns, but it's also been a big factor in the last two campaigns, as it was in the 2002 campaign between Gary Peters and Mike Cox. But the Supreme Court thing is a long-term trend. Over the period from 2000 through 2014, the spending that I have been able to verify by both records in the State Bureau of Elections and from broadcasters' public files around Michigan is spending of about $70 million, and over half of that has been unreported, unregulated spending. So the problem with that is that if we don't know who donors are, we don't know when they are involved in cases that are decided by the justices that may have been supported by major donors. And that mirrors a U.S. Supreme Court case, Caperton against Massey Coal Company, where the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that a judge in the circumstance of judging a case involving a major donor is obligated to recuse from that case because it really violates the legal opponent's due process right to an impartial court hearing.
I want to get into that just a little bit more in a moment, but I also want to go back to what you said about being able to verify this spending, because you do say in your report that if anything, the numbers that you are using are probably conservative in terms of unreported money. Why is that?
Well, it's absolutely the case. Let me give you an example. The U.S. Postal Service doesn't have a public file where I can go and find out what political mail has been processed vis-a-vis any candidates. But in the 2012 Michigan Supreme Court election campaign, I collected 13 different and unique mail pieces from the Michigan Republican Party, two of which were disclosed. And I would say conservatively, that unreported mail probably amounted to close to another $1 million. In addition to that, there has been radio advertising. For example, in the last election cycle, I heard radio advertisements about the Supreme Court candidates sponsored by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. But there are just too many radio stations for me to visit and collect those data. So I've taken the television spending as kind of a conservative proxy number to represent the great factor that unreported, unregulated spending is in these election campaigns.
So when you talk about judges hearing cases from people who have likely contributed in a way to help them win election, but of course done it in a way that their identity isn't known, is this what you mean by dark money being a bridge to corruption, as you say in the report?
Well, it is. And to state it more gently, let me put it this way. I view transparency as inoculation against corruption. We just don't know who the donors are for this unreported spending. But, you know, realistically, one needs to acknowledge that who has a greater incentive to help elect a judge who will provide their view of predictable jurisprudence, and they could feel likely would decide a case in their favor. And that would be somebody with a high-stakes appeal in the pipeline. And while that donor certainly has a First Amendment right to spend as much as they want, they don't have a right to have their favored, supported judge hear their case. And that's where we're into a question that's really kind of an ethical swamp, and we really need to drain that swamp.
I was talking with someone a while back about this issue, and they raised the question to me, well, are you sure that the judges know who has contributed to some group which is, running ads on their behalf? I mean, how much is behind the curtain that is known to the judges as opposed to what's known to us and the general public?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I have talked with partisan players on both sides who have told me they studiously attempt to keep knowledge of who the donors are from the judges. But, for example, there was a case relevant to the 2000 Supreme Court campaign where we first started having dark money advertising. And after that election, the Wall Street Journal ran a story about Daimler Chrysler having given $1 million to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who in turn gave $1 million to the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, who in turn bought quote-unquote issue advertising supporting the Republican candidates in that election. Subsequently, those same Republican justices decided a case that amounted at the time to a $29 million damage judgment against Daimler Chrysler. Now, do we know that it was Daimler Chrysler's $1 million that made that circuit onto the airwaves? Well, we really don't, because the U.S. Chamber said they were active in other states. But if you look where Daimler Chrysler had cases, Michigan was the only one of their targeted states that did. And they didn't have any cases on appeal in front of state Supreme Courts in the other targeted states. So it doesn't look good. As I mentioned, that was front page above the fold in the Wall Street Journal. It also happened to be September 11th, 2001, and it was a very short news cycle that day. But there is enough doubt as to whether the judges can be truly kept from that knowledge. And someone can pay for the judge's campaign, and if they can keep it secret, then they can have the judge who they hired hear their case. I don't think that gets us to an ethical high point, even if that kind of mystery still remains in the source of the contribution.
You also tell us in this report that the idea of issue advocacy is bogus. Why is it bogus?
Well, in the federal case decided by the United States Supreme Court to allow corporate money back into electioneering advertising, the advertisements about federal candidates immediately preceding an election, the whole discussion about this was that issue advocacy is what we would call grassroots lobbying, where the sponsor of the ad seeks to mobilize the viewer to contact a public official who can act on a matter of policy and make the change in the policy. The problem with that whole paradigm is that in Michigan, at least, judges are not lobbyable officials. You do your advocacy with a judge in the courtroom, not over the airwaves. And so the idea that somehow this is trying to move public policy being decided by these elected officials is just false on its face. And I really think that this is a question that may be open to litigation. I would love to see somebody take this question on.
Just to continue that, the idea is that lobbying is something that is more generally done with state lawmakers to try to influence their vote on a bill. That sort of thing where you might do issue advocacy, you know, tell Congressman so-and-so to make sure to vote no on, et cetera, is a different sort of thing, even if that is fraught with problems, compared to trying to do that with a judge.
That's right. One set of what passed as issue ads in the 2014 election cycle was that Americans for Prosperity ran a series of ads criticizing the Affordable Care Act and telling viewers to call Gary Peters, who had been a supporter of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and tell him this is ruining their lives or whatever kind of extreme statement went along with it. Now, one can question whether that was really an ad about the Affordable Care Act or whether it was an ad about Gary Peters' suitability to be a U.S. senator. But nonetheless, there is absolutely plausibility that it was authentic issue advocacy trying to move him to vote to repeal Obamacare. There's no such plausible scenario in a judicial election campaign. It's just false completely from the get-go.
So if Michigan wanted to do something about this, Rich, if there was interest in saying that maybe there cannot be the limits on spending that existed pre-Citizens United decision before the Supreme Court, but as much as possible, spending that is done is going to be transparent and known to the public. What could be done?
Well, a solid attempt was made to do something about it. The State Bar of Michigan, through its officers, asked Secretary of State Ruth Johnson to revisit an interpretation of our state statute that defines what is and is not reportable. Secretary Johnson concluded that, well, their case or the premise for their request was judicial campaigns because of the unsettling amount of dark money in our judicial campaigns. She couldn't make a ruling about just judicial campaigns, but she said, this is correct. We're missing all this disclosure and all of this spending. And she stated her intent to begin an administrative review process to require disclosure of what amounts to phony issue advocacy. The very morning she stated her intent, the Senate Elections Committee, chaired by Senator Arlen Meekhoff, reported out of its committee an amendment to the definition of what a campaign expenditure was. It passed the legislature, and going against a position he had established as a candidate in 2010, Governor Snyder signed that bill into law, essentially killing what would have been an administrative process that would have brought disclosure. So the legislative environment doesn't look good. Every vote that passed that bill was a Republican vote, and they have solid majorities in both chambers of the legislature. The only route to solve this problem in the near term, I think, for the foreseeable future, would be a citizen initiative. And the question then becomes, is this too small bore to excite citizens? You know, people are absolutely unsettled about the large amounts of money, the large contributions from a relative few number of sources, and the lack of disclosure. You can't do anything with the current Supreme Court of the United States about the spending level by individuals or interest groups or the aggregating of billionaires' contributions through super PACs, but you could do something about disclosure, and I just don't know whether that's enough to really animate the public and get people mobilized to do something about it. Ballot initiatives are extremely expensive propositions, and there are very resourceful opponents to disclosure who I think would spend tens of millions of dollars to oppose such an initiative. So it's not a pretty picture right now. There's not cause for a lot of optimism. The one thing that I do see is that this notion of issue advocacy in a judicial campaign is so clearly a falsehood that I think that really is worth litigation.
Just to go back for a moment to that idea of a ballot proposal, is the irony here that launching a ballot proposal usually requires a big chunk of money to begin with, and then you need more money on top of that to try and advertise and get it passed. So is money, in effect, a roadblock to trying to have greater disclosure of who is spending in judicial campaigns?
It absolutely is. I think that over the past several years, maybe two decades, really the only time you've had ballot initiatives collect their required signatures through grassroots organization have been those that have been sponsored by Right to Life. Everybody else hires petition circulators, and I think the rule of thumb is you better count on having $2 million to pay the petition circulators to get the required number of signatures to put an issue on the ballot. So that's just a start. And then I think in this case, you'd have to count on having well into eight figures to be able to run a winning campaign. And you could count on being outspent in that campaign. So there's so much money in politics now. And so much of it, in the state of Michigan at least, is undisclosed that we've really got, as I said earlier, I think an ethical swamp surrounding this whole question of money in politics.
Rich Robinson, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Rich Robinson is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. You can find a link to their report, Dark Money and Justice, Michigan is Like No Other State, at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.